I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Hello and welcome to Forma, a podcast featuring conversations with authors, teachers, creators, and community leaders who are carefully contemplating the nature and practice of classical education, an aesthetic wonder, and Christian community. I'm David Kern. In this week's episode, I had the really wonderful opportunity to chat with Dr. Emily Wilson, who recently released, through Norton, a new edition of the Odyssey. She is, in fact, the first woman to translate the Odyssey. There have been write-ups about her in the New York Times, the Washington Post, Vox.com, and a myriad of other sources online. Dr. Wilson is a professor of classical studies at the University of Pennsylvania. She lives in Philadelphia, and she has written several books about Greek literature, including translation of Greek plays and scholarly studies of other works. But nothing in those works quite compares to the task of translating Homer's Odyssey, one of the most beloved poems, one of the most beloved works of literature ever created. But not only is it beloved, it's also long, and it's complicated, and there's so many layers to it. Dr. Wilson and I chatted about the challenges of translation, dealing with expectations, working from the original text, dealing with things like people's affections for the poem and how you deal with people's opinions about a word like polytropos. And we took a step back and we talked a little bit about where her love for the Odyssey came from, what it meant to her as a child, and how her affection for it only grew and matured as she got older, as one would expect. But it was born out of a childhood sense of loneliness, she told me. The idea of not feeling like she didn't have a lot of friends around, like she was a little bit adrift in a way. And when she discovered the Odyssey as an eight-year-old, through a play where she actually was able to act as Athena, she was able to perform the part of Athena. The story was open to her in a way that I think is unique to young people, to children, and her love for the story took root then. And then, of course, it was many years later that she turned to translation. So without further ado, I want to kick it over to my interview with Dr. Emily Wilson. I think you are really going to enjoy this. I was challenged and encouraged and inspired by what she had to say here all at once, and I think you will be too. So this is my interview with Dr. Emily Wilson about her brand new translation of The Odyssey, which is available now. You can get it wherever books are sold. Enjoy. Well, my first question for you is, I guess, somewhat biographical, because I imagine that if you're going to be spending the time that it takes to produce a translation of a poem as long and complicated as the Odyssey or, you know, the other epics like it, you have to at least come from it, at least somewhat from the perspective of love or affection for the work mm-hmm. itself. It can't just be a professional duty, I would think.
Right.
So where did your love of the Odyssey come from?
I guess it comes from many different sources. I mean, just in terms of biography, I first got exposed to this story. In fact, I wrote about this in a little piece for Palace Review. I first got exposed to the story when I was eight, when I was in my primary school did a, it was the Church of England primary school called St. Barnabas Church of England School. They did a production of the Odyssey, and I got to be the goddess Athena. And it was absolute high point of that year when I was 8 years old. And I was a shy and sort of geeky kid. And it was hard for me to connect with people, partly because I was new in the school and I was lonely and I felt sort of alienated. And then I got to be exposed to this story and have this very intimate relationship with this story by playing the part of Athena. And it was so exciting to me to realize how deeply this story could speak to me. And that made me then want to read all the Greek myths in, you know, in kids' adaptations, of course, when I was eight. And then as I got older, I read the originals in translation. And then as I got older still, I studied both Latin and Greek in high school. I realized that I loved the languages as well as the stories. And then I, you know, read Homer as an undergraduate. I've always been rereading this poem, and I find that it's a poem which speaks to me in different ways now that I'm older than eight. You know, it's extraordinary that it's so much does the things that a classic is supposed to do that it can be read on so many different levels by so many kinds of people.
What do you think it was about the poem that made your eight-year-old self love it so much? You said that you were shy and geeky?
I was shy and geeky and lonely, and I was a new kid in school. So I think part of it was about how this is a story about homecoming, in which most of the poem, especially in the kids' adaptations versions, the hero isn't at home. Right. So it's about being out of place and feeling lost and scared. And I could definitely relate to all of that very deeply. And then also the fact that there was both the male hero who's lost and scared, but then the powerful female, or mostly female, goddess who is in control and can guide everything. They wanted to identify with both of those characters very strongly. But it provided these alternative models for how to be and how to live.
I do think, in my experience anyway, that one of the things that doesn't seem talked about as much as it perhaps ought to be, is Odysseus's, well, not even just Odysseus. This is true of many characters. The loneliness, the fear of their experiences that go along with that. It's, we often talk about Odysseus's cunning, right?
Right.
And how he, you know, braves these crazy adventures. But the other things that go along with that, I think, are sometimes spoken of too infrequently.
Right. So for quite a lot of the most famous and also greatest scenes in this poem, I mean, I'm thinking, for instance, of the long episode at the end of book five where he's shipwrecked and lost, and he doesn't know if he's ever going to reach land, and he's on the raft of that he's built on the island of Calypso, and then the whole raft disintegrates and he's out on the sea, all completely alone, clutching onto little fragments of the shipwrecked vessel, and he's only saved by the mysterious episode of the white goddess. And then even when he reaches land, there's no landing place. So then that evocation of what is it like to be totally alone, totally lost, totally desperate, and there might be no help out there at all. I think it's really beautifully and vividly and scarily presented. And the way that he's alone also, I mean, that Odysseus is alone also even once he gets to Ithaca, because he can't reveal himself in very, very small doses to individual people. And then also the loneliness of Penelope is really beautifully evoked in this poem as well. She's so deeply alone. She's constantly being flanked by two slaves, because the elite people in this poem are constantly having to be presented as not alone. But she's alone, but with these unnamed characters who are clearly not presented as people she can talk to. And Telemachus also is depicted as very, very alone. But there's a famous moment when he appears not alone because two dogs come with him. But he's alone. I mean, that's a way of saying he's alone.
Yeah.
All he has for company. He has no brothers. He has no friends. He only has two dogs.
And even, and they're alone, yet they're surrounded by the suitors. And
exactly.
Odysseus is around, but he's, or alone, but he's, you know, perhaps he's with Calypso, but he feels alone. He still has alone. That longing to be home.
Yes. Exactly, yes. So the loneliness of the crowd is also, very, I think, very well evoked in this poem. The way that you can be alone, surrounded by people.
And do you think that if you couldn't have articulated it as a child, that was something that appealed to your, you know?
Absolutely, yes. I think that was essential to what I liked about the story, was that I was, I had trouble making friends, and I felt that this poem somehow spoke to. I wouldn't have been able to say that at the time. I would have just said,
right,
I thought it was a cool story, you know.
Yeah.
But it was definitely about that.
Well, like every great work, there are cool stories that have so many more things going on, right?
Yes, exactly. Yes.
So okay, so you studied it in college. When did you get to the point where you felt like your love for it was turning into this desire to produce your own version of it, if that's the way of putting it?
So I'm not sure that I would have done it if I hadn't been asked. Norton asked me to do it. And, you know, at first I wasn't sure if the world needed it, you know, because there have been so many translations of the Odyssey into English already. And I wouldn't have done it if I didn't feel that I could do something really different. And then so when the Norton people asked me, I then went and read, so in some cases reread, but mostly just read for the first time. I read book 9 in something like 10 or 12 different versions, the different versions that people usually read.
Recent.
And I realized that there were things that dissatisfied me about each of them. I mean, obviously there were things to admire about each of them, but there were also things that I felt weren't being brought out about each of them, and also different things that I felt I could do poetically or in literary and stylistic ways. So that made me realize that I actually wanted to do it, not just because I loved the original, but because I felt I could create a different Odyssey. Mm. And an Odyssey that was not just different in a gimmicky way, but different in a way that was speaking to some deep and important elements of the original that weren't reflected in the, you know, 60 or 70 versions that are available right now.
Yeah. And wait, is it the New York Times that in their profile of you, I think, that mentions that most of those versions, those 60 versions translated into English, have been presented in the last century?
Exactly, yes. Yeah. So it's not that the stream has been drying up, it's actually been gushing into a, you know, whatever waterway imagery we want. But there's been more and more over the last even 5 or 10 years, there have been more and more English Odysseys, which of course is partly about the particular marketing, I mean, about the particular ways that especially the American educational system is set up, so that there were all these, you know, college classes where there's introduction to literature 101. They're going to read the Odyssey in a translation. There needs to be a translation that they can all buy and read and have your poetry version.
Right. So you felt like it would be putting too fine a point on it to say that you felt like you needed to have something to add to the conversation and not just kind of restate what everyone else was saying?
Absolutely, yes. So, I mean, I guess the conversation makes it sound like it's all like an essay. And it's both a hermeneutic question of what is the Odyssey about? What kinds of interpretation, what's prioritized in this interpretation / translation versus that interpretation? I mean, every translation gives a different picture of what the Odyssey is about. Mm. But then also, I mean, style slips into hermeneutics, right? So that it's not just about what kind of character Odysseus, it's also about what kind of poetry is Homeric poetry.
Right.
So from the beginning, a very important thing to me was to try and make sure I could create a regular metrical version of the Odyssey, because the original is so regular metrically and has such a distinctive poetic music. So that was also one of the big things I felt was missing from most contemporary translations. Hmm. Obviously, it's there in the Chapman translation, but that's 400 years old. So,
right, yeah.
Different one, yes.
So how did you go about deciding how to approach that? Was it trial and error? I mean, you wrote in iambic pentameter, correct?
Yes, correct, yes.
Was it an obvious choice to do that? Because not every translation approaches it the way you're approaching it. So it seems to, that meter seems to capture some of the spirit of the original. But let me put it this way. It seems like sometimes there is you're forced to, at least there's the idea that you have to make the choice between a so-called literal translation where you're just really capturing the exact definition of these words or whatever. You see this in scriptural translation and things like that, as opposed to being poetic. And it's like, so when people talk about which translation do I use, I'll often hear the conversation go something like, well, do you want a more literal one or do you want the poetic one? Like, what are you more interested in? Did you feel that challenge to do one or the other when you were trying to decide how to approach it?
I mean, I think the terms literal and poetic are very often used as a sort of cover for some real oversimplification about what's actually happening. Mm-hmm. You know, because, I mean, there is no such thing as a sort of literal, if you mean a version in English that's the same as the version in Greek, you know, that's never going to exist.
Right.
I mean, I've written something like, so I was saying, let's not talk about the first line, but if I were to say the first line in the order that it is in the original.
Right.
Man to me, say, muse, much turn, who, much, much wondered when of Troy, holy citadel, sacked. I could write that. And it wouldn't convey anything, I don't think. You know? It would convey something or other that's some words which correspond to some other words, but I don't think it conveys anything of what the original is saying, even on the syntactical level, because English word order is totally different from Greek word order. And I think the whole idea of what is a poetic translation is also seriously problematic. I mean, I've heard people sort of saying that my version is somehow less poetic, even though it's metrical, because it's too clear. And that, so in order to be poetic, you have to be obscure or you have to be pompous. And I just think that that's really mistaking what poetry is. I mean, if you think about Shakespeare as a poet, he's very often what Shakespearean characters, even when they're speaking as they very often are in iambic pentameter, they're often very clear.
Right.
That you have to, in order to make it poetry, you have to add in some super fancy incomprehensible imagery, you know? Mm-hmm. So it just seems to me that the whole binary is a little bit false. I mean, I think there's a possibility of either being sort of more foreignizing versus more domesticizing, but those terms are also problematic because, I mean, if you think about what is it to represent Homer as if he lived with us, as if he's domestic in our culture, what does that mean? I mean, I think on some level that you could say it's domesticizing to put Homer into an English meter as opposed to trying to put English into a Greek meter. Mm. But in either case, you're registering that this is not language which is exactly the same as how people speak.
Right.
Or if you write in a sort of clunky English that's not quite like real English, is that being more poetic or being less poetic? I think it can be being less poetic. Mm. Or if you put Homer into, I struggle with the idea that there is such a thing as the literal translation or as the
right.
as the single way of being poetic. Both of those things are problematic to me.
And of course, these are passed down through a tradition that wasn't even written. So, originally.
No, because the original poems that we have, the Iliad and the Odyssey, are written poems. They're based on an oral tradition, but they're
right. Okay,
it wouldn't exist if they weren't written, right? I mean, they couldn't have been created if literacy hadn't existed.
Right.
Early 7th century. So I mean, that's such a common sort of misstep that people make because it's based on an oral tradition. It must be oral, which isn't quite the same thing.
Right. Okay. So okay, when you were working on your translation and you were comparing it to other translations, Chapman or whoever, did you find that you were relying on the choices that those other translators and poets made? Or were you actively trying to avoid imitating what some of these other people were doing?
I didn't do either one because, when I first did the proposal for my translation mm-hmm. 5 or 6 years ago, I did this whole exercise of reading multiple different translations, like reading a little bit of multiple different translations to get a sense mm-hmm. of the different choices they're making stylistically, hermeneutically, all that. But then after that, I put them all away and I didn't look at any other translations. Well, I looked at the original and I looked at dictionaries and commentaries. But I didn't look at any other translations. So, I mean, obviously I had sort of in my mind a memory of the general outline of what the style is of each of the others. But I didn't know in detail until fairly recently how particular episodes in mine compares to others. It's only since I finished mine, I then wanted to be able to communicate with other people more.
Right.
Who haven't read the original about how is mine different.
Right.
So for that purpose, I then went back and looked at some other versions of some particular scenes. So I can now tell you how my version is different for some particular scenes. But I couldn't have told you that 3 years ago because I hadn't read them all. Mm. You know?
Did you, have you found any parts where you compared it to Chapman or whoever and you said, yeah, I got that right and he got that wrong?
Well, I mean, I've already talked in the New York Times piece a little bit and other places about the way that so many of the other translations, including, sadly, Chapman, whom I love, as well as Pope, whom I also love, and several of these more recent ones, do get wrong the way that Telemachus talks about the slave women when he's about to hang them. that the original doesn't actually make him abuse them. It says in the original that he wants to hang those who spent the night beside the suitors. And it's very straightforward language. It doesn't use any particular term of abuse. And pretty much every other translation that I've looked at imports a term of abuse. Mm. I think it's problematic, and I was surprised by that. I hadn't realized the extent to which translations are shaped by the translator's own unconscious biases. Mm. But clearly they are.
Did you see that pop up in your own, do you think, if you were reflecting back on, like, in other words, have you seen any of your own perhaps biases show up in your work? And I mean, that's maybe an unfair question.
Well, obviously I can't tell you about the things I didn't notice, you know.
Right. of course not, yeah.
Once I reread it, my own translation in 20 years, then I suspect I'll see things that I didn't see at the time.
So your translation's not your go-to source now?
Well, the Greek is my go-to source. Right?
fair enough.
But I definitely feel that I try very hard to think about my biases and also to think about what my interpretations are. Mm. And I think that's a particular kind of advantage. And I think people can tend to think, I mean, people who are not translators often think the way to do it is just to translate. Mm. You don't have to have an interpretation because that would be imposing something on the text. Mm. And I don't think of it like that. I think the way to do it is to think through whatever your interpretation is and to make sure you can fully defend it and rethink it if you don't feel like it hangs together from the text. Mm. But to be as self-conscious as possible and as conscious of the text as possible when you're trying to construct, this is how this scene makes sense, or this is how this character makes sense. Mm. So just to try and use as full an awareness as I possibly could, including of what the preoccupations are that I'm bringing to the text, as well as what I'm finding in the text, and how there's always going to be, in any reading process or any writing process, any translation process, this dialogue between what you find and what you come asking.
Hmm. Was there anything that was particularly worrisome or scary in approaching this? I mean, on the one hand, you've got this book that you love, and then of course it's a book that is beloved by so many other people. So was there, mm-hmm. were there anything, any choices that you were considering or anything like that, that made you nervous as you were approaching it?
I'm not sure. I mean, I think during the actual, you know, days and weeks and months of doing the work, I didn't feel nervous about reception in that way. I mean, mostly I was just thinking about how can I do my best by this text, and also by both these texts, both by the text I'm reading and the text I'm creating. Mm. So I'm not sure that I felt that kind of terror at the time. I mean, I think, you know, now I have to talk about it to lots and lots of different people, and some of them aren't going to like it, and I'm aware of that now, but I think in a way it's a good thing that I wasn't worrying about them. I was just trying to tell the truth.
Does it bother you that someone who is maybe committed to, say, Fagles or Mandelbaum or whoever might not like your text?
I think, you know, De Gustibus Non Est Disputandum, you know, there's no, if they just don't like it because they don't like how it sounds, then I don't think there's an argument there. It's just, that's fine. They just don't like how it sounds. And my version has a very distinctive music. And if you don't like that kind of music, that's up to you. I mean, I think there's a basis for an interesting conversation, and not necessarily an aggressive conversation, but just a conversation about to what extent do people either agree, disagree, or feel challenged by, or want to talk about the things that might surprise them when they compare my version to Fagles or to Mandelbaum or whoever. I mean, I hope that one of the things I'm doing, even for people who don't like my version as much as the Fagles version, is to show that there are alternatives. So there are ways of reading the original that are very different from the way that Fagles reads it. Hmm. And then to invite some conversation about that. I mean, to invite conversation both about, you know, what is heroism in this text, how does the poem define identity or home or belonging, to what extent is Odysseus presented as an admirable protagonist in every single scene, to what extent is the narrative always focalized through one person or through his point of view versus the alternative points of view. And I think it was actually a really interesting question. So whether or not people like it, I'm not sure if that is all that interesting. But I think whether or not people think harder about it, that's a good thing.
Yeah, yeah. You mentioned that your version has a certain kind of music to it. Did you set out with the idea of creating that music, or did that sort of happen as you were working through it?
Well, I definitely set out to write verse and to write pentameter throughout. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And I didn't know if I would feel in the process of doing that, that I could sort of count any of it as poetry as opposed to verse, you know? And I'm not sure how much of it I would count as, you know, how good is it? I don't know. But mm-hmm. I do think that I managed to make it sound, I mean, there's a danger in having a very strict formal scheme that it could sound too monotone. And I very much didn't want it to sound monotone. I very much wanted there to be a possibility that it's going to sound lush and magical, and it's going to sound like the waves of the ocean here, and then it's going to sound terrifying and stark here, and you know, there's going to be different musics going on in different moments. So I definitely I thought about that, and I think in a way it's the kind of thing that you can't do in theory or ahead of time. You have to just keep on doing it and then rewriting and rewriting to see if you can get any closer to what you want.
So why iambic pentameter specifically? Like, what you say you set out to do that. That was one of your initial goals.
Yes.
Is that because it is the English meter that most is most like the original Greek verse?
It's most like in its cultural context. It's not most like in terms of does it actually sound the same?
Okay.
Right. Because, I mean, there have been experiments in English to do dactylic hexameter, which is the rhythm of the original. But there's never been a sort of successful English epic in dactylic hexameter. There's no, you know, there've been little experiments. There were some great little experiments by Swinburne from the 19th century. But it's, I don't think it's usable because it doesn't have the same history in English. And it also doesn't have the same, I think it requires a lot of distortion of English, and it would mean that my version wouldn't have the kind of clarity that I wanted if I wanted to do dactylic hexameter. And I wanted it to both be clear and also to be paying a kind of homage to Shakespeare, to Chaucer, to Milton, to, you know, to this long history of English narrative and dramatic poetry. In a way, you know, Homer is based, as we were just saying, based on oral tradition, and it has this heritage built into it. So I wanted my Odyssey to not just have the heritage of the Greek poem built into it, but also this heritage of, you know, all these hundreds of years or thousands of years since Homer. There's some acknowledgement that I'm writing in a language which has its own poetic tradition.
That sounds like a great challenge to both be, to be responsible both for the original Greek and for the language that you're translating it into, to be respectful and yeah, just responsible to both of those traditions. That sounds like a great challenge.
It's a huge challenge. Yes. And of course I don't feel like I've sort of completely hit it out of the park in every single line. I mean, I feel like it was a very, very difficult thing to do. And I think, you know, if I've even partly succeeded in it, then that's good. But I don't imagine that there's a possible world in which I could have done it perfectly throughout. You know, it's very difficult.
Yeah. Okay. So I've used most of our time already, but I want to ask you a quick question about teaching the Odyssey, if that's okay.
Sure.
Many of our listeners work with high schoolers and even younger. And so they're trying to introduce these great epic poems to students who have never read them before. And not only that, are not familiar in many cases anymore with the context of the stories themselves. Similar to how many, unfortunately, many American students now, when you come to Shakespeare, there's no context for him. And so it's very confusing because of that, in ways that it probably ought not to be. What advice do you have for for teachers who are bringing the Odyssey to students for the first time, how would you begin? And in what ways do you think it's possible that your translation in particular can help introduce new generations of young people to this great story?
Mm-hmm. That's a great question. I hope that my version is very, very clear. I mean, I hope it's very, very readable, such that pretty much any age of person ought to be able to understand the story without being sort of too much off-put right from the start by vocabulary words. I mean, even though I hope my version, I hope the poetic rhythm and the music of it that we've been talking about so much is audible if you read it out loud, even if you just don't ahead of time know what pentameter is. If you read it out loud, you're going to hear that there's a rhythm. But it's very, very clear. I mean, I hope that you're not going to be constantly having to look things up in a dictionary, even if you're a ninth grader. So, I mean, I think if I were teaching it to that age group, and in fact, I think the same thing applies to what I would do in teaching it to undergraduates, is that I would want it to be both very easy and very difficult at the same time, and that there's a related things. I mean, that there needs to be both a sense that on some level, this is a totally relatable story. This is about a father, a mother, a child, and how they're lost and separated from each other, and how the family gets back together again. And it's also about being away from home and being back, being lost and encountering people who aren't like you, and then trying to figure out who are the people who are like me and what do I do about the others. And then once you get that far, you get into the much more difficult questions of, so what do I do about the others? Do I kill them? Do I treat them as monsters? Do I other them in all these different ways that the monsters and witches in the Odyssey or in Odysseus's travels are othered? If people try to get into my home and I don't want them there, should I kill them? Is that okay? So I think it can lead you to some very simple questions, which in fact, even much littler children are aware of the whole question of who's in my family, who's not in my family. I have a 7 and 8 year old and they're constantly talking about who is in my family and who's not. That's a very simple question, but it's a very deep question. And I think Odyssey is very deeply engaged with who am I and who is in my kinship group, who is in my community, how far does my community extend, and where do I put up the barriers? Do I put up the barriers by violence? Is there a way that I can preserve my own honor and my own identity only by saying no to the people who might want to be in my house, who are not supposed to be there? So those questions, I think, are super interesting for pretty much any age. So I would begin with those things, and I would also begin with the whole question of how much, if it's from very, very ancient times, and if it's from people telling stories when they couldn't even read and write, does that make for a different kind of storytelling? Is it trying to preserve things that we can't remember, or that we couldn't remember without telling stories? What do stories do for us? Which I think is also an interesting set of questions for kids who are sort of having all this reading and writing forced on them to actually get to discuss what does reading and writing do for us? Did the Greeks get along okay without it? And how much can we have, how much does storytelling depend on literacy? So I think I would take it in those directions as well. I mean, there's so many directions you could take it in.
Yeah. Here's my last question then about that. So one of the things that we get asked a lot when we're at an event or something is when I'm teaching something like the Iliad or the Odyssey or even Shakespeare, should I focus primarily on questions of story and character and, how is Achilles, is Odysseus an honorable man? Should Achilles have been as angry as he was? All these questions like that. As opposed to, or I guess, instead of questions of literary scholarship, say, like, at what point should I begin to teach them about the nature of iambic pentameter or Homeric epithets or epic similes or the different things that show up in these works?
Yeah.
I assume you're going to say it shouldn't be either or, but at what point should those things be introduced? Should they be introduced before you read the book to give context, or should you be reading the story and considering the elements of the story before the elements of the literature? And I know those terms are not exactly what we need for the sake of the conversation, I'm just going to use them to differentiate.
Yeah, that's a very good and very difficult question. I mean, I think it seems to me that whatever age you are, people are capable of making the distinction between I don't like this character, but I think the story does like this character, right? And so the whole question of does, if I hate Odysseus, does that mean I hate the book? How is the story forcing me to like Odysseus? And I think you could actually get to some very interesting places even just by asking that very simple question of what is the poem telling us about Odysseus? Does the narrator like Odysseus? Is Odysseus presented as the only person who matters in this poem? To what extent does the narrator or the poetic texture or the, I mean, maybe focalization is not a term that you would necessarily use in, you know, elementary school, but I think you could get to it. I mean, just the whole question of what's the point of view from which the poem is looking at these characters? Do epithets help to aggrandize the character? Are there other things that epithets can do? Which I think are really interesting questions. And I know that you said I was going to say both and of course I then, of course, yes, I would say both. But I think it's very important not to delegitimize whatever people actually think or feel as they read the text. I mean, if people who are reading the text, whatever age they are, feel particular things in response to the characters, I think it's important to acknowledge those feelings, but then push deeper into where are those feelings coming from. The text itself is making you feel some stuff. How is it doing that? And then once you ask how, you get to the literary questions.
Yeah. Well, I've used more of your time than I promised I would. So thank you so much. I probably should have led with this, but I really enjoy your translation a great deal.
Full
disclosure, I've not read every line of it yet, but what I've read a couple books. What I've read, I'm really enjoying, and I certainly plan to keep reading it. My hope is to finish it here over Christmas time. So
great. Thank you so much.
Planning for your next trip?
Elevate your travel style with Quince.
Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And it's all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/pack for free shipping and 365-day returns.